And we're particularly interested in looking at what does this mean for inflationary model building? So what I'm not going to talk about are some of these other more general things, like what does it tell you about reionization or the axis of evil, although the axis of evil will play at least a small role in what I'm talking about here. But we really want to focus very carefully on saying, what do you learn about the model space for inflation? So we're looking at photons coming at us from the epoch of recombination. I just put this up because I like this slide. And as was explained earlier, the important thing here in terms of polarization is that the last time these photons scattered, it was a Thomson scattering event. And Thomson scattering, when you have a quadruple anisotropy from the point of view of one of these little electrons here, produces the polarization that you see. And this is one of the things is that if you have adiabatic primordial density fluctuations in the primordial gas, you had better have polarization. So this is just the fact that the polarization has been found at exactly the level it was expected to be is a real triumph for inflation, because otherwise you would have some other effect responsible for the temperature and isotropy, right?
For inflation or for the microwave?
Well, I mean, in principle, the Sasseville plateau could be a foreground, right? You don't necessarily know that these are adiabatic acausal primordial fluctuations, but the polarization really does tell you that, right? It's not terribly surprising, but on the other hand, if the polarization hadn't been what it was, then we would have said, okay, something's really wrong with our basic model here. So this is Kobe and W map. You've seen this before. And just to recap a little bit, since we're looking at the surface of the sphere, the surface of blast scattering, the way we expand this is in spherical harmonics, and then the multipole spectrum is just the amplitudes, the average square amplitudes of these ALMs. Since the universe is isotropic, we don't expect that there to be any M dependence. So if we have a Gaussian random distribution of fluctuations, all of the information in the CMB is contained in the spectrum of CLs. If it's non-Gaussian or something like that, these CLs will miss something. Okay? For example, alignments in the axis of evil aren't captured in the CL spectrum. And the name of the game for parameter estimation is we take a cookbook with a number of parameters, omega matter, omega lambda, omega baryon, whatever you want to test, put it through a Boltzmann equation, which is nice and linear, and out comes a set of CLs that you then compare to the observed spectrum. What set of parameters you choose is an important thing to worry about. Okay, so sometimes your results are going to be a little different depending on which parameter set it is that you choose to marginalize over. So here's the CL spectrum from WMAT 3-year data. Quadrupole is still low. There's still another low point. There are a couple of outliers, but basically, as we saw, this is much cleaner and better behaved than the WMAT 1-year data was. And in addition, we have out here, we have these extra points going out past the third peak. So this is really remarkable. This is incredibly high quality data. And it's also really remarkable that a simple best fit lambda CDM model, 5 parameters, actually fits this thing this well. You know, it's really cool. Here is WMAP plus a bunch of the other experiments. We saw this figure a little bit earlier, so I won't dwell on it. But we're measuring things out to really all of about 1,500 now, getting a really long lever on the CMB. And we've also, and WMAP has also made a really beautiful measurement of the polarization. So in polarization, because this is a tensor quantity, because we have these directions, essentially these directionless vectors on the sky, we, just like we expand the temperature anisotropy in spherical harmonics, we expand the polarization anisotropy in tensor spherical harmonics. And they have an even parity kind and an odd parity kind. Okay? And scalar fluctuations are only going to create the even parity mode. And these will only be created by gravitational waves. So instead of just one spectrum, we have 4. We have the autocorrelation of the 3 different things, the temperature, the even parity mode, and the odd parity or B mode. And we have the cross-correlation between the temperature and the even parity mode. These other cross-correlations vanish by parity. Okay? So now instead of having one spectrum to fit to the data, we have 3, T, E, B, and C. And this one hasn't been very well measured yet. It's also, this one is created only by tensor mode. So if the tensor modes are very small, we're not going to ever see this one. But we have, WMAP has done a nice detection of all 3 of these other guys. Here's the temperature autocorrelation. Here's the cross-correlation, and here's the E-mode, or even parity, autocorrelation function. So now we want to say, okay, what does this tell us about inflation? The basic scenario of inflation goes like this. We have some potential for some scalar field, V of phi, that is essentially undetermined. What we want to do, the name of the game here, is we want to say, what can we learn about this potential? And this potential is, if the field is sitting way up near the top of this thing, this potential creates an effective, like, sort of dynamical vacuum energy, right? The equation of state of this is, it becomes very much like the cosmological constant, which causes an accelerating expansion of the universe. So you have this quasi-exponential expansion of the universe at early times because of a scalar field that is sitting somewhere up near some equilibrium point, up near the top of the hill or the bottom of a hill where it's flat. So if the universe is dominated by the scalar field matter, and it's, in particular, if it's dominated by a homogeneous mode, the Friedmann equation becomes particularly simple. This is just the energy density of the scalar field, and this is the Hubble constant, a dot over a squared. And if this thing is slowly evolving, this thing is going to be somewhere close to a constant, right? The scalar field equation of motion in terms of the scale factor is given by this. So you have phi double dot plus v prime of phi is equal to zero. Those are the normal pieces that you'd see in a Klein-Gordon equation, plus this extra term, which is drag from the cosmological expansion. And the scale factor under the influence of the scalar field is proportional e to the integral of h dt, which is often written e to the n, where n is the number of e-folds of expansion. And this variable, this number of e-folds, is going to be a very important variable for determining what our observables are in inflation time models. So typically what we will do is work in the limit that the potential dominates the energy density, so that this thing really does act more or less like a cosmological constant. Phi dot is so small that it's this thing is dominating the expansion, and also the equation of motion of the scalar field is dominated by drag on the scalar field. So this thing is moving very, very slowly down this potential, and it's causing nearly exponential expansion in the universe. We can parameterize this by a couple of dimensionless variables called slow roll parameters. In particular, we can write the Hubble constant as a function of the field, So this field is monotonic. We can use the field value essentially as a clock. So we can write the Hubble constant as a function of the field value, and we define a parameter epsilon, which is essentially h prime over h squared. In the limit that the field is slowly rolling, that the energy density is dominated by the potential, this is just given by v prime over v. There's a typo here, that should be squared. Okay, so this is essentially, this parameter is the first derivative, the ratio of the first derivative, the slope of the potential to its height. And this is a useful parameter because the equation of state of the scalar field matter in terms of this parameter epsilon is given by this. So if epsilon is less than 1, we're inflating, and if epsilon is greater than 1, we're not inflating. Okay, so this is p is less than minus 1/3 rho is epsilon is less than 1. The other parameter that's important for observables is essentially the second derivative of the scalar field potential. It's more conventionally written as h double prime over h, which in the slow roll limit looks like v double prime over v plus a term that depends on the slope. Sometimes people just leave this one off and define eta to be that piece, but this is an alternative definition. There's a sort of a nomenclature clash in the literature, but I'm going to be defining my eta in this way.
So that's exact.
Yeah, that's it. When you define it as h prime over h squared, that's an exact statement. It does not depend on slow roll, right? So epsilon is an equation of state parameter. And in the slow roll limit, it's given by this, but this definition is independent of any assumption of slow roll, as is this. Yeah?
So the old definition of eta had a nice physical interpretation, just a mass of the input on measure.
Yeah.
What's the reason you choose this strange?
This is because, I'm not going to, unless I have a lot of extra time, which since we started late, I definitely won't have. This is convenient for defining a higher order hierarchy of these slow roll parameters in terms of the set of flow equations. And defining it in terms of h double prime over h just turns out to be more convenient from a formal perspective. But for most models, if epsilon is small, this thing is awfully small. So if you, for example, in hybrid inflation models, this term dominates, they end up being physically equivalent. So it's just a matter of convention. There are two types of perturbations that are produced during inflation. One is gravitational wave modes, which are redshifted outside the horizon and frozen on super horizon scales. And this is just given by the amplitude of tensors is just essentially the square root of the autocorrelation function of a free scalar field, which has an amplitude of order of the Hubble constant. And in inflationary models, it's given by something approximately a power law, where the tensor spectral index is given by this first slow roll parameter. Right? So this is the first slow roll parameter tells you what the spectral index of the gravitational wave mode is going to be. Similarly, scalar fluctuations are produced by fluctuations in the inflaton field itself. Since this is the mass density, it's the energy density of the inflaton that's dominating the expansion, the fluctuations in the inflaton actually couple the fluctuations in the curvature of the background spacetime to first order. And so the scalar power spectrum is given by the change in the number of e-folds with respect to the field times the field variation, which ends up being the Hubble constant divided by this first slow roll parameter epsilon, square root of it. And that is also a power law that's conventionally written as n minus 1, where n is 1 minus 4 times epsilon plus 2 times eta, the second slow roll parameter. So for any inflationary model, if I determine those two slow roll parameters, I determine the power law behavior of the two spectra that I'm looking for. And the name of the game here is going to be to try to figure out what's n, and in particular, what's n, and also what is the ratio of the amplitudes of this tensor to the scalar spectrum. Right? And this is this parameter r, which is the ratio of the amplitudes of these two spectra, and it is given by 16 times this equation of state parameter in a conventional definition. And this guy is not an independent parameter, but it's actually related to the tensor scalar ratio by what's called the inflationary consistency condition. So we have two spectra. The amplitude of the scalar spectrum is fixed by normalization at the quadrupole, so that's not really a free parameter. We fix that by normalization of the CMB. So this other parameter is fixed by the consistency condition. So what we have to describe inflationary models is really a two-dimensional parameter space, if we don't consider variation with scale in these numbers. And I'll talk about scale. Well, I'll talk about running of the spectral indices a little bit later. So what would be the relevant parameter space for plotting inflationary models against the data is the scalar spectral index versus this tensor scalar ratio, so the ratio of the amplitude of the two spectra. And different kinds of models give you different predictions for these things. And so it's convenient to just take different inflationary models and to dump them into sort of very broad general classes. And the ones that I tend to prefer using are what I would call large field, which is things like m squared phi squared or lambda phi to the fourth potentials, where the field value is displaced a long way from its minimum and it's just rolling back down to some zero energy vacuum state. Right? So these are probably the very simplest inflation models that you could come up with. Exponential potentials would fall into this category as well. An alternative would be things that look like spontaneous symmetry breaking, where the field is sitting up on top of a hill, a metastable equilibrium or an unstable equilibrium, and is rolling off the top of the hill, and inflation ends dynamically when this thing gets down here close to its vacuum expectation value. And these things, if the field is way up near its maximum, you can always approximate them by whatever the leading term in the potential is. So this is going to be 1 minus m squared phi squared or 1 minus lambda phi to the fourth or something like that, right? So whatever the behavior is down here, since you're inflating up near the top, you only have to really keep the leading term in order to determine what the prediction of this kind of a model is. And the last kind of a model is what I'll call a hybrid inflation model, which is essentially, the way I'm going to define it is you have a field that's evolving toward a vacuum expectation value that has a non-zero value for the cosmological constant. So formally speaking, inflation would continue forever. Right, this thing would just settle down here to its minimum, which would have a non-zero vacuum energy, and inflation would go on forever. So you need another field to end inflation. You have an auxiliary field here that you have freedom to put essentially wherever you like. That field then ends inflation and through an instability. Right? But for the purposes of the dynamics that are generating the perturbations in inflation, this thing is effectively a one-field model. Okay. So you can come up with multi-field models of inflation as well. I'm not really going to discuss models that intrinsically depend on their multi-field nature. A lot of models, for example, non-canonical models or models involving multiple degrees of freedom or modified general relativity models and things can be mapped to effective single-field models, effective canonical single-field models. So this class of models is broader than just things that are fundamentally canonical single scalar field theories. Lots of other theories at the end of the day when what you care about is predicting inflationary observables end up being one of these things. Okay? So this is not completely general, but on the other hand, it captures a lot of most inflation model building. So the nice thing is that these different kind of models predict different things for the spectral index and the tensor scalar ratio. So this is a plot of spectral index on the bottom versus tensor scalar ratio. And more formally, one can define these small field, large field, hybrid models by inequalities between these slow roll parameters. Okay, and this is another reason why it's convenient to define eta this way, is because you can actually do this division formally in terms of slow roll parameters. All right. So basically, small field models tend to predict low tensor scalar ratio and a red spectrum. Large field models tend to predict a lot of tensors, but still a red spectrum, red as in n less than 1. And hybrid models tend to predict a blue spectrum. And in fact, most common hybrid models, things that go like 1 plus pi squared or 1 plus pi to the fourth or something, lie on this little line here with almost no tensors and a blue spectral index. So let's take a look at models, a particular type of model, and say, okay, we'll take a look at the WMAP data and see what the WMAP data allows us to constrain for a particular model like this. So the model, the first kind of test case I'm going to use here is a potential that looks like V of phi is some vacuum energy scale times phi over mu to some power p. All right.
Sorry, how did you get R of order 1?
Back over here. How did I get that?
So you're allowing models that don't have slow roll?
Well, I mean, in this limit, yeah, things are going to, well, R is 16 times epsilon here, right? So this is still, you're still slowly rolling in this region, right? So this is normalized to R is equal to 16 epsilon. One thing about this is that how you relate R to the slow roll parameter is something that in the literature has a number of different definitions. So old papers use 13.6 epsilon, later papers use 10 epsilon, the WMAP team uses 16 epsilon. I've even written ones where I just said, screw it, and we'll just make the normalization 1. So I am actually, in all of these plots, I am using normalization for R consistent with the convention used by the WMAP team, okay, which is R is 16 epsilon. So a large field model. So this is the kind of thing you get with chaotic inflation, right? You have this field that's displaced a long way of order m plot from its minimum and is rolling back down to phi is equal to 0, where the vacuum energy vanishes. And going through this, I'm not going to go through the steps and how one does this calculation, but if you work out the perturbation spectra for potentials like this, you can show that spectral index is given by 1 minus 2 plus p, where p is this exponent here, divided by 2 times the number of e-folds, where the number of e-folds here is how many e-folds before the end of inflation did the quadrupole exit the horizon. Okay, so n is equal to 0 is where inflation ends. And n gets big as you go further and further back in time. And because of ambiguities in the reheat temperature, the number of e-folds at which the quadrupole did its horizon exit, so scales of order of the quadrupole in the universe today, exited the horizon somewhere between 46 and 60 e-folds before the end of inflation. And this uncertainty is due to the fact that you don't know how hot the universe reheated to after inflation was over with. And if there's time, I'll talk a little bit more length about that problem. But for our purposes, what we want to do is we want to calculate spectral index and tensor scalar ratio as a function of the potential and of the number of e-folds. And this is a fundamental uncertainty in our calculation. We can't determine this better than about a factor, better than 2, between about this much. This is reheating to 10 to the 16 GeV, and this is reheating to a TeV.
So that's not the number of e-folds of inflation.
No, inflation can go on for much longer than that, but all of the scales for n bigger than whatever this number is are outside our horizon, so we don't care about them. So this is our current horizon size today, right? It's not the total number of e-folds of inflation. Yeah. Okay, so, and depending on p and n, we want to say, okay, what is the WMAP error bar rule out? Here is the WMAP data from Spergel et al. Okay. And here's the plot that we saw earlier. And that's what these dots are here. On this plot, this is a p is equal to 4. This is a lambda phi 4 large field model. And this is a p is equal to 2 model, n squared phi squared. And this thing here is Harrison-Zeldovich. That is an n is equal to 1, a completely scale invariant spectrum with no tensor fluctuations. So the conclusion that you get looking at this plot is that lambda phi 4 and Harrison-Zeldovich are both cleanly ruled out by the WMAP data, and this is WMAP alone. This is WMAP not in combination with any other experiments. There's no issues of systematics or anything like that here. These guys are ruled out to well over 2 sigma. according to this plot. What I'm going to argue is that this plot is, we believe it to be incorrect. Yes?
You're going to perform about Harrison's lower spectrum, where you're also going to comment about models which have n larger than 1, right?
In this case, models, for example, hybrid models are really cooked, right? I mean, because except 1 plus n squared phi squared, or the simplest hybrid models all live at r is equal to 0 and n greater than 1, and those are pretty firmly ruled out by the data.
You are not going to exchange it?
Probably not, and I'll show you figures that will show you exactly what I'm going to
do. So do you know in the DBI inflationary models, or maybe somebody, what's the spectrum? Is it red?
DBI, if I remember rightly, gives a blue, red spectrum. That's kind of right around in here. Yeah, so I think DBI is still okay. So you can take a deep breath.
Well, I like hybrid very much.
But the comment you were telling me in the office, one was, well, maybe I should let you even talk, but at least to this point, you have a particular hybrid model in mind.
Right, this is distinct from the hybrid mechanism, right?
I don't think like brain inflation hybrid model is ruled.
I think generically in all the models, when you explicitly compute the potential, you will end up having absolute zero. Like what Willis said, it's very close to zero, and eta is positive. So that pretty much tells you that n.
Those models are in serious trouble.
So that's at least.
Yeah.
When you do the realistic computation of potentials, that's what comes out.
Epsilon is equal to zero and eta positive
are
in serious hot water right now. Yeah. Okay. And nothing I'm going to say is going to change that. Even when I show you the error bars that I think are right, that's still true. All right. So this is the result in Spergel et al. And it's a little bit too optimistic. And let me explain why I think that's true. Here are, we downloaded the chains from Spergel, from the WMAP chain that were used, presumably, as far as we can tell, to produce this figure in the paper. And here is our version of this plot, and plotted in a way that we know is wrong. All right? And it's not exactly the same. In particular, going up and going up here is a little bit different. But so along here, it's pretty comparable. Yeah.
So I show this plot, and this is the other bug generating this plot.
Yeah.
We know it's wrong. It's just the data are correct, the chain are correct. It's just that
the chains are correct, but the plot is made wrong.
Plotting level is labeled
right.
Through that. So it's
right.
Just that,
right.
I didn't want to bring confusion, so I didn't show it.
But yeah. Well, I'm sort of explaining exactly what's wrong, and if I'm getting anything incorrect about, because I didn't do the data analysis, so we're sort of reconstructing the scene of the crime from behind. So, you know, it's we think we have an idea of what's going on.
I'm saying just that it's really a bug, a simple trivial bug as a plotting level, so it's nothing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is, and what we did wrong to create this plot was, in order, we plotted these contours at the likelihood level that would be appropriate to a one-dimensional Gaussian instead of a two-dimensional multivariate Gaussian. So we plotted these contours when the chi-squared fell off by e to the minus 1/2 and e to the minus 1, which is what you would do if you had a one-dimensional Gaussian distribution. But if you have a two-dimensional Gaussian distribution, the likelihood values that you plot those contours at should be different. Okay, and so I don't know whether you know whether this was exactly the mistake that was made or not, but but it matches pretty well. So this is, here's the m squared phi squared, here's the lambda phi to the fourth, here's lambda phi to the fourth, m squared phi squared. These are quite consistent with one another anyway. Okay, so this is sort of, and here's your Harrison's old Hilbert spectrum here, ruled out. If you do the contours correctly, if you actually plot them at the right likelihood values, these are the error bars that you get. They're a lot bigger. And in particular, Harrison's Aldovich is inside the error bar, and so is the kind of 5 to the 4th.
I wish that we take it seriously.
The plot is wrong. The numbers and the significance of deviation from NS and all those are correct, right? It's just a visual.
The one-dimensional numbers. And I'm going to show our calculation and your calculation. Yeah. I'm going to disagree with your conclusion that Harrison's Aldovich is ruled out, and I'm going to explain why I'm disagreeing with it. Okay.
Well,
so
everyone is disagreeing with you anyway.
No,
So, no, I want to make absolutely clear. I'm not implying that they ran the chains wrong or there's a problem with the observation or anything like that. It was just like there was a screw up on the plot. And if you look at it, it gives you really the wrong impression about what the data are telling you.
Yeah. Can you explain what chains are?
I would really rather not, but chains are the we're talking about Monte Carlo Markov chains. We're talking about the sampling of the parameter space and the like. So what you do is you go around and you sample this parameter space in a stochastic way. You calculate likelihoods for millions and millions and millions of different CL spectra, and then you find the ones that are a best fit. So when I talk about a chain, what I mean is all the points that were used to calculate these likelihood functions, right? And the WMAP chains are available on the web. We just downloaded them and redid this plot. So this is actually using data from the WMAP team. All we did was replot it.
So this is consistent with WMAP1.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, it's not nearly as amazing looking as a Sperzel et al. plot.
Nothing's changed.
So it's not as big an improvement as this plot would lead you to believe.
Again, on this plot, where is
W1?
W1? Yes, there's a 1 year contour.
Oh, I don't have the 1 year contour on here. I'm sorry. It's a little bit bigger, right? So it kind of goes up, maybe about like that, right? So.
Basically, it's saying that the visually is different, but the actual.
I'll get to that. I'm going to give you numbers. Okay. Any more questions about this thing? Okay. So presumably, I think you guys are in the process of fixing this, right?
We submit later this week about the versions.
Cool. Yeah. But so in any case, okay, this is the size of the error bar that you should really be thinking about when you're looking at this data. So we have also run our own chains. One of the nice things at Buffalo is that we have the Center for Computational Research, which has a number of very large computers. So we have been running chains on an 800 node. Each node has 3.2 gigahertz Intel Xeon Irwindale processors on it. So it's a very big computer. It's a lot of fun to play with. And we're running the Cosmo MC code, which is by Lewis and Bridle, and you can find information about it in this paper. So it's a very commonly used Monte Carlo Markov chain code to do this analysis. And one of the nice things about the way the WMAP team has done things is they publish a likelihood code that actually does the data analysis. If I have a CL spectrum and want to compare it to the data, there's a code that's released by the WMAP team that does that correctly, taking correctly into account all the correlations and all that stuff between the error bars, right? So it's very nice of them to do that so they can actually get these likelihoods calculated correctly rather than just winging it. You know, so they do a very good job with that. So we have what we've gone and done is gone back and redone the full likelihood analysis for a couple of cases that are covered in the Sperzel et al. Paper so that we have our own, because for one thing, they haven't released all the chains, especially with including running the spectral index that I'll talk about a little bit later, so that we're generating some of our own to use for our own nefarious purposes. Here is our result for a 7-parameter fit of the CMB. So we are marginalizing over omega baryon H squared, omega cold dark matter H squared, theta, this is the position of the acoustic peak, reionization optical depth, scalar spectral index, tensor scalar ratio, and normalization at the quadrupole. So this is consistent with, I forget which, M6 or something model that in Sperzel et al., with the exception that, I'm not sure, did you guys use the inflationary consistency condition or not? Yes. Do you remember? You did? Okay. We're fixing W is equal to -1, so we're assuming a cosmological constant. We're assuming a flat universe as prior. We are assuming the inflationary consistency condition as a prior. And we are also putting in priors for Hubble Space Telescope, a value of the Hubble constant, which is going to be important, and priors on the age of the universe, what's called a standard top hat prior in the Cosmo MC code. Yeah. All this means is what you're doing is I have 6 parameters, okay? And I want to say what sextet of those parameters is the best fit to the data.
Yeah.
Right. So what I do is I go and calculate a bunch of different models for different values of those parameters, right? So, and what I mean by marginalizing is if I want to just put make one of these two-dimensional plots, I actually have to take into account the fact that at any one point on that two-dimensional plot, I have a four-dimensional parameter space that I can search over to find the best likelihood for that spot, right? And so marginalizing means what I'm doing is I'm integrating out all the parameters other than the ones that I'm plotting in a statistically consistent way so that I'm taking into account the possibility that those parameters might vary as well as the parameters that I'm trying to plot. Right, exactly. Right, so, and what I've done here is each of these is the likelihood function for one parameter with all the other parameters integrated over, and then just going through each parameter. So this is basically, this is how, if you want to quote a number that n sub s is equal to x plus or minus y, what you want to do is you want to marginalize over all of the other parameters. You want to integrate out the effect of those parameters. And because if you just like keep all the parameters constant at the very end, you're going to get a tiny little error bar, because you're not taking into account the fact that some other parameter might change, which would move the best fit for n over someplace else, right? We're varying these guys, we're fixing these things, and then this is the probability distribution for each of these parameters, including the effect of all the other parameters on the likelihood. That is the difference between the posterior probability and the mean likelihood, which, if these things were true multivariate, perfect multivariate Gaussians, these things, the dotted curves and the solid curves, would line up. So the difference between these curves tells you how much the real distribution differs from an ideal multivariate Gaussian. So what you want to look at is the black curves. So our value for the spectral index, doing this, assuming no running of the spectral index, is 0.98 plus or minus 0.025 in a six-parameter fit. So Harrison-Zeldovich, when we integrate everything down to a one-dimensional likelihood on the spectral index, Harrison-Zeldovich is within one sigma of the best fit. Well,
sure, go ahead. Well, R is n is for one very positive, right? So should be something called zero here. Shift n.
Right. I have the WMAP numbers in the next slide. So.
Okay.
So this is actually the numbers from Spergel et al. For their equivalent seven parameter fit. All right. So that RN plot that I plotted the error ellipses, this is the fit that they did. All right. So in their error ellipse, they have n sub s is 0.987 plus or minus 0.986 plus or minus 0.03 or so. Right.
But do you agree that there was Harrison's and Zeldovich before there was an equation?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just giving you the numbers here. I'm not arguing philosophically about whether Harrison-Zeldovich is preferred. I'm just saying that, okay, if you do this plot over this particular seven set of parameters, remember, lies, damn lies, statistics, and Bayesian statistics, right? So now, if you do a six-parameter fit, that is, if you do exactly the same thing, but you constrain this parameter R to be zero by fiat, if you take this, you set this to zero, and then you marginalize over the other six parameters instead of seven parameters, Spergel et al. Get n 0.951 plus or minus 0.02, and Harrison-Zeldovich is ruled out barely to two sigma. Yes.
So what is the value of R in your case? And given that value of R, what would be the amplitude of the tensor fluctuation?
Okay, well, I'll show you a plot. The way to see that is on one of these two-dimensional likelihood plots. And here it is. Okay, so the blue curves are the Spergel et al. Results. The red curves are the results from R analysis. The difference is we get significantly tighter error bars than they do, primarily because of our constraint on Hubble constant. In order to get these guys up here to be a good fit to the data, you have to have a Hubble constant in the high 80s.
If you're actually fitting the peaks between 100 and 800, then it's not terribly sensitive to the high events. It's down large angles that it starts to curve.
Well, the longer the lever arm you have on the spectrum, the better the number you get for n sub s. Right. Yeah, I don't know that the third peak contributes.
So,
I think it's the polarization is really giving you more information on this than the third peak
is. Now that you're changing n sub s, this tells you something about the amount of power at low L.
Well, we'll get to low L when we talk about running, too.
We can't get what they would get.
What who would get?
Well, you would increase the size of the arrow again. So you go down to L equals 1 through 3.
Uh-huh.
It starts to cut the size of N.
Don't understand what you're getting.
Well, when you change N, okay?
Mm-hmm. This is N normalized at low L. Right, this is n calculated, k is 0.002 h megaparsec inverse. So this is, we're normalizing this. Our pivot scale is at quadrupole here, or at L equals 10, or it's at L equals 10 formally, but it's at large scale. All right. So this is actually n normalized at very large angular scale. So this is, you're looking at but you're looking at a fit over the entire spectrum with the assumption that it's pure power law. Okay. So in this case, now to answer your question, the Harrison-Zeldovich spectrum is this diamond right here. This is R is equal to 0, and N is equal to 1. And it lies right on the 2 sigma contour.
My question was, so in your case, what is the value of R? You can still have R equals 0.
Yeah, R is equal to 0, and N is equal to 1. It's right there.
Not the Harrison-Zeldovich. I mean, your central value is...
What is the value of R for this central value? No, I'm marginalizing over R. There's no way I can tell you to answer that question. It's not a meaningful question, right? I can have, so that's what this plot tells you, is to 1 sigma, I can have any combination of R and N inside that little region, and to 2 sigma, I can have any combination of R and N inside that little region. So this plot is the thing that answers your question. But when I only quote a one number with an error bar, what I've done is integrated out all the effect of that. So there's no way for me to tell you what the value of R is. I'm not assuming any one value of R. I'm integrating over all possible values of R in the likelihood.
I guess I can rephrase my question. Is there a way to constrain this plot if you will say, so we haven't seen or we haven't detected the gravitational waves? So then we don't see, then there is a lower bound, there is sort of an upper bound on R.
The upper bound on R is 0.6.
Okay, so.
That's what the vertical axis on this plot is. Okay. Have I answered your question? Maybe I'm misunderstanding.
No,
okay.
You answered what they
are. Okay. So in this case, as far as I can tell, to 2 sigma, lambda 5 to the 4 still barely makes it in if you have 60 E folds, and Harrison-Zeldovich still barely makes it in any reasonable way of saying what's ruled out to 2 sigma, as far as I can tell. Even with these error bars that are a lot tighter than the ones from the WMAP team, and if you look at these blue ones to 2 sigma, then neither one of these things is really ruled out to any real significance.
So, can you comment, what is the blue part and the green part?
These are m squared phi squared potentials, these are lambda phi to the 4. Okay. So that's the main message here, is that if you look at it carefully, in fact, the claim that Harrison-Zeldovich is ruled out to more than 2 sigma, and the claim that lambda phi 4 is ruled out to more than 2 sigma, is not really very strong. However, if you look at hybrid models, right, things that have a epsilon very small and eta positive over here, they're looking like they're in pretty bad shape. So I want to look at another particular constraint on a small field model. So let's take a look at potentials that look like spontaneous symmetry breaking, where I have some vacuum energy scale and 1 minus some phi to the power n. If I have a 1 minus m squared phi squared, which is probably the most natural from a particle physics perspective, I have values for the spectral index that depend on essentially this mass scale, depend on the mass of the inflaton in this way, right? And so that I have, if n is greater than about 0.9 or so, that means the width of this potential, this mass scale mu, has to be bigger than about 0.9 m Planck or so. And this will vary a little bit depending on the particular choice of potential, as we'll see. But what that means is that if I have a 1 minus m squared phi squared potential, the typical vacuum expectation value of the field that is going to be consistent with inflation is of order m Planck or bigger. And the spectral and the tensor scalar ratio is given in terms of the spectral index and the number of e-folds by this exponential relation. And I'll show you a plot of where these things end up. Models for which the mass term is suppressed, on the other hand, behave much more nicely. In fact, the density fluctuation, I don't have the density fluctuation amplitude listed here. It's a complicated exponential expression that doesn't really add much to the discussion. But the nice thing is if I take 1 minus lambda phi to the 4 type potentials, because these are essentially scale-free potentials, right, then the Planck scale drops out and the density fluctuation amplitude is just given by the ratio of the height of the potential lambda to the width of the potential mu. And the spectral index is independent of any of the mass scales in the problem. All of the masses drop out of your expression for the spectral index, and n minus 1 is given by minus 3 over the number of e-folds, which for n goes from 3 to, for n is equal to 4 anyway, for p is equal to 4, I'm sorry, this uncertainty in n means that this lies between about 0.93 and 0.95.
Which is 1 minus 3 over n.
1 minus 3 over n, I'm sorry, yeah, there's a typo in that. And typically, tensors are highly suppressed in these models, so that you're going to see a tensor scalar ratio of nearly 0 and a slightly red spectral index. Okay. An example of this kind of small field model, one of these 1 minus m squared phi squared, is natural inflation. So in natural inflation, what you have is you have spontaneous symmetry breaking, and then you have this Goldstone mode that is actually the potential for that gets tilted, and the inflaton is this angular mode that rolls down this angular potential, and you have a potential that looks like something like a lambda to the fourth 1 plus cosine. Popular recent examples of this are racetrack inflation and the various variations of it, which are basically variations on a very old idea, which is natural inflation, which has been around for a long time. And in every respect, they're basically natural inflation in a string context, right? So you should be thinking of racetrack inflation or something like that when I'm talking about this, if you want to be stringy about it. And one of the questions we want to maybe ask of the data is, how wide is that potential? What is the symmetry breaking scale that we're talking about for this thing? And the new WMAP data gives you a number that looks about like that. So this is the Spergel et al. Error bars in blue, not ours. And what you get for the Spergel et al. Error bars is that the symmetry breaking scale, the width of this thing, has to be greater than about 0.7 m Planck or so. Right, so these horizontal, the black lines are for different choices of the number of e-folds, the red lines are for different choices of the width of the potential. So it actually gives you a meaningful constraint on the shape of these things.
You have no other constraint on n?
On n?
Yeah.
The number of e-folds?
Yeah.
No. Oh, okay. That's it. Yeah. That's just the shape of the potential and the number of e-folds. That's what you get. So these kind of models are still alive and well. They fit the data very nicely. As do 1 minus lambda phi to the 4 models or something like that, which all tend to live down in here. All right. So here is a big zoo plot of a whole bunch of different choices of potential. This is power law. The blue line here is power law inflation, e to the minus phi over mu. These big blue contours are the Spergel et al. Error bars, correctly plotted. The black line is a linear potential. All the large field kind of chaotic inflation type models are these guys living up here. So this is m squared phi squared, 1 minus phi to the fourth, m squared phi squared, phi to the fourth, phi to the sixth, or whatever. The 1 minus phi squared type potentials live along this red band. And the 1 minus phi to the p, where p is greater than 2, live in this green region here. And these are a very nice fit to the existing data. And just for fun, since there's one person in the audience who's actually at this talk in 1996, Shana was there for this. So this is a figure from my PhD thesis defense, which, to my, as far as I know, this is the oldest existing version of the zoo plot. So.
You mean you kept this thing all these years?
Yeah. Hell yeah. I have a big drawer full of all my old talks. So there you go. And in particular, we were writing models, papers about models with 0.93 to 0.95 spectral index in 1995 or so. So I get to brag about that at least. So running of the spectral index, if you include scale dependence in that value of n, right? So now if you allow deviations from a perfect power law, these things from the point of view of the slow roll expansion are higher order and slow roll, right? So these would be things of order epsilon squared or eta squared or higher order parameters. Then if you do an 8-parameter fit, this is the results from the W map team. In particular, here is N versus R, normalized at 0.02. And the best fit to N, if you allow running as an additional parameter, is now blue instead of red, which is very confusing, isn't it? Lies, damn lies, statistics, and Bayesian statistics, right?
It just sounds like putting too many parameters in.
Yeah, well, this is the issue, is how many parameters are enough and how many parameters are too many, and that's something of a judgment call. Yeah, well, and this is with the pivot at 0.02, and that's very important. If we put the pivot at 0.05, it would be red, right? Because if you allow a DV, if it's a pure power law, it doesn't matter where you normalize it, right? You're going to get the same answer. But now if there's a shift in the power law, the value of the spectral index that you get with your best fit is going to depend on what wavelength you choose to make that fit at, right? So it's all self-consistent.
So basically, I mean, I'm not exactly but the point remains that there is actually a criterion.
Right. So that there is. I'm going to show you increases in the. I'm going to show you numbers.
And you know, if you violate the criterion, you get all kinds of.
Yeah. Numbers. Meaningless stuff. If you choose too few parameters, then you're not significantly constraining your models. If you choose too many parameters, you just get junk. So where's that balance? And so this is one of the reasons I'm showing that plot, is to stimulate a little debate about that.
What you need is a theory. Not a theory.
It's a paradigm. Yeah. It's a paradigm in search of a theory. Okay, so here is the WMAP result. So that this is still consistent to 2 sigma with a red spectrum. But one of the interesting things here is that, let me see, here is the plot of running versus tensor scalar ratio. So this is the fit for DND log K. And in the WMAP1 data taken alone, that is without Lyman alpha forest or 2DF or anything like that, the no running case was within 1 sigma, within the 1 sigma error bar. Okay. So one of the funny things about the way this data has been presented is in WMAP1 they said we have 2 sigma evidence for running. But that was including Lyman alpha forest and large scale structure data and stuff like that. If you took all that out and just looked at what WMAP alone told you, in fact, the no running case was inside the 1 sigma error bar. All right, so there was no evidence whatsoever in WMAP1 alone for running. Now there's still not really evidence for it, but in fact, the 1 sigma error bar is actually in the negative territory. So in fact, the WMAP3 data has stronger evidence for negative running than the WMAP1 data did, despite the fact that the plots look a lot weaker. We're working on this too, but I'm not going to show you our plots. Some of you have seen our preliminary plots, and we have reason to believe that that they're not right. So I'm not going to confuse you by showing you stuff that I know has problems with it. I'm not sure, do you know whether these plots have the same contour problem? They do. Okay. So these plots are also wrong. So nobody has yet put out a correct plot, including running.
Monday.
Good. I'm really looking forward to that. So how many parameters do you need? All right. So here is, from Skrugel et al., a list of all the different parameter sets that they tried, right? So they even did, for example, binned power spectra, where they just allowed the power spectra to vary in binned without any assumption at all of a power law, da-da-da-da, mass and neutrinos and stuff like that, right? So the... What you want to read here is this column, which is relative to the standards 5-parameter lambda CDM best fit model. If I add or subtract parameters, how does the best fit value, what is the likelihood value of the best fit change? So a positive means the fit gets worse, and a negative number means the fit gets better, and this is the delta chi squared. So if, for example, I assume scale invariant fluctuations, if I put a prior, not only is R zero, but the scalar spectral index is, if I put a prior that's a Harrison's Doppler spectrum, the delta chi squared is 8. So it gets worse, but not terribly worse. If I assume there's no dark matter, it goes up by 248. Now there's a detection. Running spectral index improves the fit by 3, which is not as good as assuming a non-flat universe. Okay, so you don't really get much. You don't gain anything by including tensor modes in your fit. and you don't gain much of anything by including running. So from Joao's point of view, these are meaningless.
Well, even the doormats are meaningless.
Well, what is meaningful here? You tell me.
Well, I think the five parameters are always meaningful.
Okay.
Anything beyond that, it's, yeah. If you start using these information criteria, you are
right.
The penalty you have to pay for putting another parameter is bigger
than what you gain here. Yeah, these are very modest gains. And,
those two.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is the five parameters. Yeah, so you're saying you like this one the best.
The five parameter is better than,
okay,
than the one we did.
You're dropping it down or you're those?
Yeah.
I'm dropping NS, right?
Okay. Dropping NS and R. You're still keeping tau in this. Okay. Do you know what the best fit value for tau is for this five parameter model? Do you remember?
It's the same. Because it's driven by tau. It's driven by polarization.
Okay.
So you can use polarization only.
Right. It shouldn't make any difference. Okay.
I think there's an issue between, I mean, the argument I can make is valid, dropping tau and NS separate, and not both. So again, an issue about what is the base model.
But, but as we said earlier, tau and NS don't understand physical graph. So it's tau, you know that tau that exists, right? So with NS, depends on one, you don't really know.
Right.
But the metal engineers get finalized, you know
the. You know the. They have it sometime, right? Well, I mean, that's the issue, is what is the actual universe doing? I mean, one can argue about, you know, what bag of numbers is the most appropriate bag of numbers to use to fit the data. But the real question we want to answer here is what's the actual physics that's happening in our universe, right?
Right.
And strictly just like using using likelihood arguments from Bayesian analysis doesn't give you that information. You have to eventually apply Phase, right? I mean, you have to. Otherwise, you're not doing physics. You're just doing numerology.
So it's true because you got various things. But even then, going back to the information criterion, you basically did an improvement of about 14, 20, if you're not 8, introducing. To get the evidence, please see.
So, I mean, I think that's consistent with the fact that n is equal to 1 is not really in any meaningful way ruled out. So Harrison-Zeldovich is still in, but just about any way you slice it, as far as I can tell. So.
Sorry, I'm a little confused. Simple question. So the fourth one is low cosmological constant.
Ah, but curvature. No, wait a minute. What is this one? Anyway, I don't remember.
It's an open model.
It's an open model.
Open model.
Okay.
For curvature. But then you don't put the prior on the Hubble constant. No prior on Hubble constant.
Okay. Yeah. So some of these are.
The first year data you had, like four sigma detection.
That's not their Hubble or not.
Yeah,
Hubble prior or not.
Okay. And it's reasonable to put a Hubble prior on, right? We've measured the Hubble constant. Well, this is the problem with Bayesian analyses, is that you can end up confusing yourself more than that. Okay, so I think we've got to the first point of my summary, that it's not really so simple to look at this data and say, oh, this is, it's the smoking gun for inflation and, you know, everything that you read in the New York Times and all that kind of stuff. It's like, what? I know you didn't. I'm not accusing you of doing that. But those of us with hotlines to Dennis Overby, gave him some good quotes. And it's the real data is.
Brian Greene's talk at the press conference.
I didn't see that.
Blogs.
So as far as I can tell, Harrison-Zeldovich is okay, and Lambda 5.4 is still barely okay, hanging on by its fingernails. You know, we would have liked to have seen at least one of these things get killed off, but the WMAP3 data, at least taken alone. Now, one thing that is not clear is if you combine it with SDSS and this other kind of stuff, how well you can do, but I don't think that that's really doing a lot for you. Yeah, so sorry to tell you, but at least in my estimation, that we really haven't gotten as far as we had hoped to get with this. The best fit spectrum is red, unless it's blue, or maybe it's gold, we don't know. No, hybrid models are still killed off. Okay, evidence for running is actually stronger in WMAP3 than in WMAP1, despite the fact that they said they had a detection in the first paper and no detection in the second paper. The evidence actually got better. Axis of evil is still there, which I'm sure everybody is busy talking about. I'm just going to bring it up as related to this point, right? So the, one of the things is that the reason you get this evidence for a blue spectrum when you normalize a 0.02 is because you have these low points, especially the quadrupole, that are dragging your amplitude down. So you have to have the amplitude go up and then turn around and come back down again, which is exactly what you get with a negative running in a blue spectrum.
Yeah, that's the, I mean, this is the only half the way, kind of. The low L, where's the way it's coming from in the full running, it's like half the way, half the guys come from the low L.
I haven't personally gone and tried to play games with what happened, yeah, where the weight is coming from and stuff. You probably know better than I do. So
it's driven by the lower, which is important.
Okay, that's good to know. Simple hybrid models that tell you, give you a blue spectrum, no tensors, and no running are pretty much dead. So we have actually managed to kill off one large class of inflationary models that, in fact, are really a lot of supersymmetry-based kind of inflationary model building is based on these simple hybrid models, right? So that if you allow running, you can have a blue spectrum. But in order to have a blue spectrum, you have to have a lot of running. And so that those hybrid models, typically because you're going to a late-time attractor, have an incredibly tiny, highly suppressed running. So these 1 plus m squared phi squared with an instability in an auxiliary field kind of models with a blue spectrum, low tensor scalar ratio, and very, very highly suppressed running are just not a very good fit to the data. And that kills off actually a substantial class of models. So if all is not lost, we've really got it somewhere. But we have, in terms of these things, these guys are still in play, but I would say that there's substantial pressure on these kind of simple hybrid models. And I just want to show you what the future is going to hold. So this is the zoo plot with the WMAP error bars. The red curve is how big this error bar would be for a cosmic variance limited measurement up to L of 1500. The blue error bar is what you would expect for Planck. The black dot is what you would expect for something CME pole-like. In order to do this, I just took Planck and increased its sensitivity by a factor of 3. And of course, the location of this error bar is arbitrary, right? It's just the size of the error bars that matter. Right? So I picked a fiducial model here, not knowing what the real data was going to be, and then just plotted the error bars. Luckily, when I actually picked this point in 1998, I picked it right in the middle of what would eventually be the WMAP error bar. So I didn't have to change the plot much. It made life a lot easier for me when the new data came out. And these three lines are different sensitivities, predicted sensitivities for different possible configurations of the Big Bang Observer satellite. So this is how low one could possibly expect in the most beautiful of all possible universes. With unlimited funding, you could probably detect an R maybe of a few times 10 to the minus 4 or so. So there's still a lot better, we can still do a lot better in this game than we've done so far. But the existing data, this is a substantial improvement over what we had previously, and the future is still pretty bright. So thank you very much.